Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. For some years now, the Bush administration has been arguing for a special unit that perhaps not special, but to the extent that it's something that it's not commonly done, for there to be uniformed troops assigned to duty inside the United States to assist state and local governments in the event of a terrorist attack or some other kind of natural disaster. Now, there are some people who make the argument that that is a good thing, that in fact, since 2001, we've become aware of just how vulnerable we are to something like a terrorist attack here in the United States. Others say that this plan raises some serious civil liberties issues. Some people even go further to say not only is this just a bad idea, they believe that it could well be illegal. We'll be discussing that and more broadly talking about homeland security this morning in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Professor Michael Greenberger. Since 2001, July of 2001, he's been a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. Before that, he spent 20 years practicing law in Washington, D.C. Then in 1997, left private practice to become the director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. In that capacity, he was responsible for supervising exchange-traded futures and derivatives. After that, he served as counselor to the U.S. Attorney General, then became the Justice Department's principal deputy Associate Attorney General. When at the Justice Department, he was responsible for supervising a number of counterterrorism programs. And in 2002, he became the founding director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. This has a staff of 55. They work on a broad range of homeland security and emergency response issues for federal, state, and local government agencies, as well as medical researchers. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are just brief in their comments so that we can keep moving along. But of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Greenberger, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Very good, thanks.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. The thing that sort of caught our eye and we thought that we'd like to start talking about is this this plan that I'd mentioned, that is to set up these units. There would be, I believe, three of them. We're talking about, say, in round figures, I guess, about 20,000 soldiers. They would be in place sometime within the next maybe 2 years. 2011, I think, was the target to date. And that they would be essentially, as I said, as I understood it, set up, specially trained to deal with things like chemical attack, nuclear attack, other things like that, also to deal with natural disaster, and that they would be ready to be deployed where needed to help state and federal officials to deal with something like that, whatever would come up. Can you just talk just a little bit more about how this would work?
Well, essentially, as you stated earlier, after 9/11, there was a concern that there would be a need for the use of military personnel within the United States for various issues to protect the well-being of people living in the United States. Actually, some steps were taken in that regard. For one, for the first time, the military set up something called the Northern Command, which is a command structure within the Department of Defense that has responsibility for the sovereign United States. And there is a command structure that is devoted to protecting what is called the homeland or the sovereign United States. Secondly, going all the way back to Reconstruction, there is a statute, a federal statute on the books that says that armed military forces or active military forces shall not be used for law enforcement purposes within the United States unless authorized by statute or by the Constitution. This entire issue has been a source of great confusion and controversy. The statute goes by the name, the Latin name of Posse Comitatus, mm-hmm. The confusion played out, for example, over Hurricane Katrina. As you will recall, that hurricane left people in New Orleans in very dire straits, and there was an active debate within the Bush administration about whether federal troops should be used, one, to go in and rescue people who were caught in the Superdome and the Convention Center, and two, there was a time, and history now has this as a source of debate, when law and order broke down in New Orleans. Some people say it never happened, but at the time people were saying that people were roaming the streets, and there was a view that the only institution that really could have solved the problem was to put the active military in there at the time. And the Bush administration wanted to get the permission of state government to do so. And the governor of Louisiana said that active troops could be used, but only if they were under state supervision, which was unacceptable to the president. So this has been an active debate going on. After Hurricane Katrina, Congress passed a statute that said that active military could be used in response to a natural disaster. And it was opposed by every governor in the nation, and that statute was on the books for about a year. And the next opportunity to repeal it, Congress did so. So it's a source of great confusion here, and the Bush administration has sort of been flipping in the wind about what to do with it. They've got this plan that you've articulated, but it's a very controversial plan, and no one's quite sure how it will all end up.
So then the if one asks the question, this particular plan that we're talking about, this the stationing of having these uniformed troops in the U.S., their purpose being to help state and local officials deal with terrorism or with some domestic catastrophe, if you ask this question, well, does this is this plan a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act and illegal, it sounds as if the question, the answer to the question is, well, we're not exactly sure.
Well, the first thing is, if the plan were implemented by by congressional legislation, it would be legal, because the overarching template rule is that you can't use active military for law enforcement purposes unless Congress authorizes it or it's authorized by the Constitution. If Congress authorized it, that would remove all questions as to whether or not it would be legal. If Congress does not authorize it, it would be a very open question as to whether it would be legal. There are various statutes that are on the books. For example, there's a statute that authorizes the active military to be used if there's a nuclear attack. There's a statute that authorizes the active military to be used if there's a biological attack, like smallpox or plague or something of that sort. There's also a statute on the books that says that the president can use the military if law and order has broken down in a jurisdiction. But these statutes are subject to a lot of debate. There's debate over the overarching policy about whether the active military should be used. And then there's a debate as to whether the laws that would authorize this are clear enough that they overcome the general rule that you should not use active military for law enforcement purposes.
Mm-hmm. Is it clear that we're talking about a relatively small number of soldiers here, 20,000. And it's my understanding, at least the plan that as I have read about it says there would be three units, they would be based different places, and that they would be there prepared for rapid deployment if they were needed. So that sort of would be the idea. Is it clear that number, you know, say in each unit we had 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 soldiers, that would be a very significant contribution to whatever resources state and local authorities could put behind dealing with something like a terrorist event or something as bad as Katrina?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think the states would probably be very, very upset about such a policy. Their view essentially is that Katrina was a one-off and that for most normal natural disasters, the state, and don't forget, the states also have access to the National Guard units that have not been federalized, that they are fully ready to take care of these kinds of events, and that whatever happened in Katrina happened because of poor management in Louisiana. And the other factor that needs to be added into that discussion is that there is something called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which is a compact to which each state is a signatory, and that allows governors, and you'll see this happen in various natural catastrophes, to call upon neighboring states to add to their resources to fight wildfires or, you know, a terrible hurricane or something of that sort. And in fact, in Hurricane Katrina, I don't remember the exact number, but a very substantial number of first responders from neighboring states, in fact, states all over the country, went to Louisiana under that emergency assistance compact. The point is, most states believe that they're able to handle this without active military intervening. And the second point is that the military, I think, is quite capable if there is a situation where, for example, a state really feels that it's overwhelmed and wants to call on the federal government. I believe the Department of Defense is sufficiently well organized that they don't need the special task force of 20,000 soldiers. That is to say, there have been situations where the military has been asked, sometimes not in a law enforcement capacity, but just to supply equipment, where they've been very capable of doing whatever needs to be done without establishing some kind of special forces to deal with that job. So either because the states should, in I would say 95% of the instances, be able to handle the situation themselves, or in those rare events where they're overwhelmed, I think that the military is already well enough organized that it can use existing personnel, that there's no need for this plan of having 20,000 forces set aside, specially trained to intervene in these kinds of situations. Hmm.
Just very quickly, for anyone who might have tuned in, let me introduce once again our guest for this hour, Michael Greenberger. He is professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, has been on faculty there since July of 2001. In 2002 of May, he became the founding director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. This has a good-sized staff, 55 people, that work on a broad range of homeland security and emergency response issues for federal, state, local government agencies, as well as medical researchers. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We started out talking here a little bit about a plan that has been proposed actually for some time now. The administration has been talking about it, and now the Defense Department says they are planning on doing that, and that is to set up three units of uniformed troops based inside the United States to help state and local governments in the event of either natural disaster or terrorist attack. Questions here, again, are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just one further question. Again, what I have read about this says the Pentagon plans to do this. They plan to have these soldiers in place by September of 2011. But given the fact that we are going to have a change of administration here, and given the fact, as you have said, there are questions about whether this is appropriate, whether it's legal, where the lines of authority are, that perhaps state governments wouldn't be real happy about this. Is there in fact some chance that actually this won't happen?
Oh, I think there is a chance that it won't happen. I think it will be given a lot of consideration and fresh review. One of the reasons also, I think, that would be an argument against doing this, aside from the obvious concerns that people have about the military being devoted to engaging within the United States, is also because of the Iraqi war, and now it appears the Afghanistan war is going to require more attention to the military, the National Guard forces have been depleted, so that when a state needs to call upon its own National Guard, Obviously, many of those armed services personnel are in Iraq, and it looks as if even as we draw down in Iraq, they're going to be in Afghanistan. That has meant that the states have been somewhat shorthanded in this regard. But I do believe that over time, and possibly as early as 2011, that we will have our National Guard troops back in the United States, and therefore this kind of scarcity of resources, which was somewhat demonstrated in Katrina, because we were in the thick of the Iraqi war, the scarcity will be eliminated, and states will be able to rely more on their own resources. What governors worry about, and the reason Katrina, I think, gave state government a bad name, is that it can be very, very confusing to a governor responding to a localized situation to have to worry about whether the military is suddenly going to introduce itself into a state. And the presence of the military raises serious problems, for example, for a governor to maintain adequate control over trying to fight whatever the emergency is. And I believe the states have had such a strong voice on this that this kind of proposal will be actively reviewed. And because of an increase in, hopefully by 2011, in National Guard support, there really wouldn't be any need for this kind of specialized force.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'll start with someone in Effingham on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello?
Well, a couple of comments. It appears to me that the dictatorship of a capitalist leader, the utmost, is the president, and that's what I think is being discussed here. But if I can give a kind of an overview, since 9/11, which, you know, is keeps burgeoning forward as it happened yesterday, was predictable. And I think any concern about the use of biological or atomic, quote, terrorist attack would be the ultimate desperation of by those who are labeled terrorists or would resort to some such thing as that, and their hopelessness, because they would have to know. I mean, the so-called terrorist is no more ill-informed or understand the world we live in than anybody else. But if their hopelessness becomes that desperate that they are willing to see their own population destroyed by airborne atomic weapons, and a place like Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia or anywhere else that this hot spot is pointed to as the origin, then would be nuked to ashes. And they know that. And that's why it now has gotten down to the dictatorship, because we then are told that we have to have this dictatorship in Washington for our own safety. Those are my comments, and I'll ring off. Thank you.
Well, you can respond to that, Professor Greenberger, any way that you like.
Well, I think the caller reflects a very serious concern, let's just say, about the active military forming some elite group to be responsive to emergencies. I mean, it does call into play concerns about, you know, the military involving itself in domestic government, and possibly, you know, people cannot remove from their minds the idea that the military might be used to take over domestic government in some sense. And I think there is a civil liberties concern about this. I think most civil libertarians are quite concerned about the military playing an active role in domestic law enforcement. My own view is that whatever the number in we talk about, 20, we're tossing around the figure 20,000, and some people might think that doesn't sound like an awful lot, but it seems to me that many people, and I think most of the state governors, are not happy about having an elite set of troops whose sole responsibility is to come in and deal with disorder within the states, because somebody's disorder, maybe somebody else's a problem that isn't great enough for that kind of, you know, substantial military involvement. Where I come back to is I think the military is already well enough organized that if needed, they can be called upon by the states to support their efforts. I think that having an elite forces is a very something that's very threatening to a lot of people, and I think there's no need for that threat. And I think that if the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the two principal federal agencies that would have to respond to some kind of calamity, are adequately organized, they can organize themselves in a way to support state government rather than to take the state government over by inserting the military, who would only be responsible to the president.
All right, let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Refresh my mind first. When President Eisenhower activated troops in Little Rock, those were National Guardsmen, weren't they?
They were actually federalized National Guardsmen because mm-hmm. in the civil rights era, when the federal government was trying to impose integration policies, the states would not go along. So you couldn't use a state National Guard, so the National Guard was federalized. And there are a series of episodes where the President of the United States has felt that it's necessary to enforce federal law. It's been done very rarely, where over the opposition of a governor, he will deploy federal troops that are only answerable to the president. And the caller is exactly right. The Little Rock Central High School situation in 1957 was one of those rare instances. The president was operating then under something called the Insurrection Act, which gives the president the right on his own orders to send federal troops into an area where law and order has broken down. And President Eisenhower made a determination that the issue about integrating Central High School in Little Rock had become so controversial and there were so many threats to the peace that federal troops were intervened. Another situation was the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles in the early 90s. Now, in that situation, the governor actually asked President Bush, the first President Bush, to bring troops in because the governor himself recognized that he couldn't maintain law and order. So there are these isolated incidents under the Posse Comitatus statute. Remember, I said the general rule is you can't use active military for law enforcement unless a statute or the Constitution authorizes it. In those two instances, a statute authorized the intervention of the troops. In Little Rock, there's a provision in the Insurrection Act that when the president makes a decision that federal rights are being interfered with because of disorder, he can introduce troops on his own without the support of the governor. Or in the Rodney King riots, where the statute provides the governor can request support. But those have been very limited instances. They're not the general rule. They're the exception. And my concern is that having specialized troops that are trained to intervene, you know, when you have troops trained to intervene, they don't like just sitting around, so they're going to be looking for excuses to intervene. And for that reason, I think it puts puts too much emphasis on federal intervention.
I have a comment and a question then. When we can barely raise enough troops to maintain the army we have in Afghanistan and Iraq, how are we going to raise another two divisions of troops? The other question is, would you comment on the dangers of trying to privatize such a force? I can see Blackwater trying to get the job. And it seems to me that may be even more dangerous than federal troops, although I agree with you. Federal troops seem to me extremely, extremely precarious.
Well, first of all, privatizing, I think, would be the worst remedy. And as the caller demonstrates, the Blackwater scenario or many other things that have happened in Iraq using private resources to perform military functions has not proven to be a wise policy. And I believe that there would be no way that you could get a substantial majority in Congress or get the governors to agree to the privatized use of resources. With regard to the short, are being short on military personnel right now and the high irony of raising another 20,000, I think that's a very good point. I mean, the Department of Defense, and I believe President-elect Obama is supportive of this, is trying to put as many troops in place in Afghanistan right now as they can get their hands on because of the fear of losing Afghanistan to the Taliban. And I think that's exactly right. There's a scarcity of resources, and the idea that you're going to use 20,000 people on a contingency that they're needed as opposed to putting them where there's no doubt that they're needed does not make a lot of sense. And as I also said earlier, my hope is that by 2011 we'll have, if things work out well, and of course that's a big if, and we can draw down in Iraq and we can stabilize Afghanistan, we then will have a lot of the National Guard returning to their various states from which they came, and they will then be in place to support a governor in responding to a catastrophic emergency.
Well, this in a sense, is kind of a side issue, but I am interested in having you talk about this maybe for a moment or two. I'm curious about what exactly is the relationship of the National Guard to the United States military, and how is it that the president would have the authority to call up a National Guard troops and have them serve along with regular military outside of the United States?
Well, simply put, by statute, the National Guard is in the first instance a state organization, and under the auspices of the governor, who's considered to be the commander-in-chief of military forces under his control within his or her own state. But by statute, the National Guard can be federalized. In other words, you can take the state institution and make it into an institution that responds to the President of the United States. And when you see all these National Guards personnel going to Iraq, they have been federalized. And what generally, as you could well imagine, the federalization of the National Guards was thought to be the exception rather than the rule. I mean, it was to give the president reserves, in effect, for the routine military operations. What happened was the exception with regard to Iraq, the exception swallowed the rule. That's why you had so many guardsmen who, you know, signed up thinking they would be, you know, staying in their states and dealing with problems relating to their states are now one of our major backbones of our effort in Iraq, and you have them pulled out of their communities, not available to the governor, and rather than being in the sovereign United States, being sent all over the world. That was, while the laws may not have been abridged in that regard, it certainly wasn't the purpose of the whole National Guard structure to effect, make them the backbone of the active military. Mm.
And so then no state governor could say to the President of the United States, look, Mr. President, I recognize that there is this need here, but you also have to recognize that that the Guard, the purpose is here to be here in this state, whatever the state is, and to be here in case of unforeseen emergency. We could have a natural disaster. We could have a terrorist attack. We could have any number of things, and that's what it is these people signed up for. But apparently a governor would not have the authority to say to the President of the United States, I'm sorry, Mr. President, but you can't have my National Guard troops?
That's exactly right, and that's, in fact, how we've been fighting the war in Iraq.
Mm. All right, let's go on to another caller. Maybe just very quickly, I'll introduce again our guest, Michael Greenberger. He is professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, has been there since the summer of 2001. He has also been an attorney in private practice in Washington, D.C. He worked at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission for a number of years as their director of the Division of Trading and Markets. He also served as counselor to the U.S. Attorney General and then became the Justice Department's principal deputy associate attorney general. In 2002, he became the founding director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Charleston, Illinois, and that's line number two. Hello.
Good morning. A couple of questions or comments, really. As to the issue of the National Guard being somewhat unexpectedly used in places like Iraq, that was not unexpected at all. If you look at a biography of Colin Powell and some of the post-Vietnam War writers, there was a concerted effort on the part of the U.S. military to integrate the National Guard as specific specialist troops, like water treatment facilities involving construction and the like, for the specific objective of making sure that in any future conflict, that a Vietnam a scenario where the Guard wasn't used at all or very limited way was, in fact, would be used and would thereby gain a political support that had been lacking during the Vietnam War. The second thing I'd like to comment on is that it's hard to believe a scenario of either Canada or Mexico invading the United States. So absent that, it seems to me that a specialist type of counterinsurgency group, maybe through the FBI, would be what would be required. And that is an organization that that basically is highly highly mobile, highly trained to counter specifically nuclear and chemical biological threats. Putting a couple divisions of the U.S. Army in that role doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense, and I speak as a former military person myself, so I appreciate your thoughts on that.
Well, I agree with the second commentary about developing divisions, especially designed to deal with these kinds of problems. My own personal view is, from talking to various military personnel, that if worse came to worse and active forces were needed, that the Department of Defense is established sufficiently well to be able to move other personnel in to be of assistance in such, you know, either a terrorist attack or a very severe natural disaster. For example, with regard to Hurricane Katrina, the first institution that was properly activated and ready to go in to provide help was the Northern Command, or the part of the United States military that is right now devoted to the United States. And forces were deployed, and I believe in Florida and Georgia, waiting to go in, and they were never called upon. And I think they could have gone in, not so much in the law enforcement effort, but to provide equipment and rescue services and other things of that sort. I might also add that the Coast Guard, which is not subject to the prohibition of use in domestic occurrences, was probably the most efficient institution in responding to the problems that arose with regard to Hurricane Katrina. And with regard to the caller's first point, he's absolutely right. You know, technically speaking, the National Guard was organized to supplement the active military, or has been organized to supplement the active military. I think this, the assumption was that if you had an all-out major conflict where you were deploying hundreds of thousands of forces, that the Guard would be called upon as a supplementary unit. What we have in Iraq is that the Guard is, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but you have maybe 160,000 troops at the height, and the Guard is a very high proportion of that, much more than was ever contemplated in the sense of the relationship of the National Guard to the active military. What I'm trying to say is the National Guard was used much more than anybody ever contemplated as part of a 160,000-person force. And, you know, I think both governors and guardsmen themselves have been astounded, not only in the sense that they've supplemented, but that they've gone back for several tours of duty. There just hasn't been the active military's heavy involvement in this, but rather the rotation of the National Guard one, two, three, sometimes four times. And the governors, I know, believe very strongly that it's depleted their own ability to respond to problems in their various states. Now, most of those responsibilities don't have to do with law enforcement, but they do have to do with responding to natural disasters, wildfires, tornadoes, hurricanes, problems with drinking water, things of that sort. And it's been a very serious problem over these last since 2003. And it's sort of a shame to say, well, since the National Guard has been so depleted, now we're going to get divisions of the active military up to speed and have them take their place. It's sort of turning the whole structure of protecting the American people on its head.
Again, I want to thank the caller. We're moving into about our last 12, 13 minutes. Our guest is Michael Greenberger. He is professor of law at the University of Maryland Law School. He is also the founding director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. We're talking here generally about homeland security issues. Specifically, we started out talking about this proposal that has been made to create several units of uniformed troops stationed inside the United States that would be there for rapid deployment to help state and local authorities deal with either terrorism or natural disaster. The number of questions have been raised about this plan, whether it's a good idea, whether it's legal, perhaps whether it will be implemented at all. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next up, we have a caller in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello. Would you address the issue that what seems to be confusing to me here, or puzzling, is why these specialized groups of individuals with specialized skills, say, take a scenario, there's a terrorist attack involving a so-called dirty bomb, you know, a nuclear material-laced weapon that causes a lot of problems and so forth, or a biological attack, say, why the parties that would be needed to have the special skills required to deal with a situation like that have to be under the active military, and for that matter, or armed with anything other than, say, sidearms, just for their personal protection while they're going about their tasks. Why is that necessary? Although I suspect the answer might lie in that the fact that the present administration, the outgoing administration, has seemed to want to make the office of the president that of emperor and bring within its grasp more and more control of things rather than the other way around. Would you comment on that, please? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the point is well taken. Obviously, when you're dealing with, say, a nuclear device, there was a recent report done by a congressional committee, or the committee given congressional authority to do it, and they did, within the last month or so, warned that the country was vulnerable to the use of nuclear devices or biological devices, and anticipated that there would be one such attack before 2013. And you could understand a desire to want to have troops that are specially trained to deal with nuclear weapons or deal with biological pathogens that are highly contagious, like smallpox or plague, or something of that sort. The problem I have is the following. I mean, there is absolutely no reason, the caller suggests this, that you couldn't train state forces to deal with that. And if one state was too small to have the expertise, there are these compacts that allow states to support each other. Why you couldn't do it under those auspices? Well, the answer to that question is that states are simply overwhelmed with their responsibilities. I mean, they've been given new responsibilities from A to Z since 9/11 to carry out various missions, and they've been given no funding to do it, or very little funding. The funding, when you analyze it, is really quite laughable. I mean, you're talking about millions of dollars when, you know, if Citicorp is threatening to go bankrupt overnight, the Fed can raise over $300 billion to support that bank. The states and cities are operating on pennies compared to that. And then, of course, when you throw on top of that the present economic meltdown, the devaluation of housing prices, every state practically, there are very few that aren't in this situation, but most states are in terrible financial trouble and are looking hither and thither to cut budgets. So it's not a time for states to be able to beef up their own responses. One of my complaints since the advent of the post-9/11 world is that the federal government has really shortchanged the states completely. They've given them enormous responsibilities and very little money to carry it out, and you'll frequently see that states and cities are upset because they didn't get as much as some other state and city got, but they're bickering over, you know, $1 million here, $1 million there, when we're talking about the safety of the American public. So I think in the most orderly fashion possible, when we get out of this terrible economic crisis, that we need to reorder our priorities and make these kinds of concerns about health and safety. These health and safety concerns under the Constitution were principally given to the states. It's called the police powers. And that's been recognized by putting one new assignment after another on the back of the states. But I think when we're out of this meltdown, financial meltdown, and we've reordered our priorities, that the states must be given more assistance to be able to protect themselves and not to come up with these silver bullet kinds of answers of getting 20,000 specialized personnel to run all over the country to assist the states.
Well, this points to a basic question that we really haven't talked about, but maybe I'll give you a minute or two to try to address that, and we'll try to get some more callers. And that is, we have certainly seen, as a result of natural disasters like Katrina, that if we have some event that causes great displacement of people, simply moving people and then finding some place to put them and take care of their basic needs is an enormous challenge. And if we layer on top of that the fact that we might have some contamination issues as a result of some kind of weapon of mass destruction that was chemical, nuclear, or biological, then question comes, is any state, how well prepared would any state be to deal with such a thing? And are we any better prepared now than we were on the 10th of September of 2001?
Well, we're better prepared now than we were then, but we're not as prepared as we should be. And I think most states, and Illinois, the work of the Illinois state apparatus is one that I've have had contact with, and I think is would be ranked among the best states in terms of being prepared. But the overwhelming problem is the lack of resources. In some sense, you look at the Mumbai situation, for example, which is probably for the year 2008, the most serious terrorist attack that's taken place. What happened? I mean, they used conventional weapons. They didn't use nuclear weapons. They didn't use biological pathogens. So when you combine my own personal view is that our biggest problems are going to be of very conventional nature, that if you will have the kinds of episodes that you see in Iraq with people detonating bombs on themselves or using other conventional methods to cause disruption. And you add that kind of problem onto the natural disaster kind of problem. I think a lot of these problems in the first instance can be handled at the local level. There's no doubt the federal government has to be prepared to supplement local resources. But we'll never get our local governments, state governments and localities in the shape they need to be in unless we give them the resources they deserve. And I think, you know, trying to worry about getting an elite force to move around. For one example, you raised the problem of when there's a natural disaster, there's a need to evacuate people, move them into another jurisdiction, find housing for them. With the most recent set of hurricanes, that program didn't work as well as it should have. But this elite force isn't going to be able to deal with the kinds of recovery problems that you find in Louisiana, the Gulf Coast, or any of these other situations where there's a natural disaster. That's really the problem of state governments and private charities, all of whom are suffering now from a lack of financial resources.
Hmm. Well, let's try to get at least one more caller here. We'll go to Champaign County. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi. Just a sort of a postscript, and maybe it underlies why there's so much suspicion, is that this federalization of the National Guard, the statutes that apply to that changed in the Reagan administration during that Central America war. There was Dukakis, Governor Dukakis, who's actually on this show last week, had a lawsuit against the Reagan administration for trying to federalize or federalizing the National Guard. It was obviated by a Montgomery Amendment, which allowed the federal government to take more liberties, I guess one might say, not the right word, in federalizing the Guard. And obviously it's not the same subject you're talking about, actually having a dedicated federal force for the local, but, I mean, it underlies why there's so much suspicion of a unitary executive power in this day, I think.
Yeah, I think the caller is exactly right. You know, there are all sorts of suspicions. Ironically, the Posse Comitatus Act arose out of the desire of the southern states to get federal troops out in Reconstruction. It didn't really come from a civil liberties standpoint, but I think the statute and the general template that active military shouldn't be used for law enforcement purposes except in extraordinary circumstances is something that civil libertarians now are very appreciative of, and obviously you've got these so-called 7 days in May scenarios that people worry about. And I think the lesson of the Iraq War is that the governors, and I believe the governors are fully aware of this, have got to have better command over their own resources. And rather than make it the general rule that the federal government can take over the state National Guard, it should be only done in exceptional circumstances, and there should be restrictions on its use. And one of the reasons, if not a civil libertarian concern, is that, you know, the weather patterns in this country have become pretty horrific. The hurricanes are coming faster, the wildfires, the tornadoes, and the National Guard is simply needed at home to protect the states. And I think it will be a priority for the governors to get that situation reordered in the coming years.
We're just at the point we have about 2 minutes left. And, you know, something we actually haven't talked about, perhaps what we should do is ask you to come and talk with us again, is the relationship between health or health as an aspect of Homeland Security. And as I've mentioned a couple of times, you are the founding director of the Center for that's called the Center for Health and Homeland Security. And I think that we now have reason to remember that something like a natural disaster may be much more likely than a terrorist attack, and some kind of very serious health disaster, perhaps a serious outbreak of infectious disease, for example, could be something that could happen, and again, might be more likely than a terrorist attack. What way is health connected to Homeland Security?
Well, it's Homeland Security has now been converted into, when I first started, everybody thought it was all counterterrorism. After Hurricane Katrina and the Federal Emergency Management Agency is in the Department of Homeland Security, there's now within this academic area a so-called all-hazards approach, and that is you're planning to protect for the welfare of people. Is planning that can be done both to, in response to a natural disaster or a terrorist attack. In either situation, a terrorist attack using weapons of mass destruction or a serious natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina, there are inordinate health consequences. You know, people are sick, you run out of supplies, hospitals are overwhelmed. You also have the prospect of avian flu, which is part of our mission as well, which would be a very serious natural causing infectious disease that would overwhelm our healthcare providers. So everywhere you look, whether it's a terrorist attack using weapons of mass destruction, serious natural disaster, avian flu, in the aftermath, there are enormous health consequences. And, of course, everybody knows our health system has enough trouble keeping up with day-to-day conventional concerns. Were there to be a rush on our hospital system because of a smallpox attack or a natural occurrence of avian flu, it's simply going to be a nightmare to respond to it. So our mission has been to try and help healthcare resources, departments of health in the states and cities, to organize themselves as best they can to deal with those kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry to say that there we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Professor Michael Greenberger. He is professor of law at the University of Maryland, and since 2002, he has also been director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Professor Greenberger, thanks very much for talking with us.